This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. Imagine spending more than 2 decades in prison for a crime you didn't commit. That's exactly the nightmare scenario North Carolinian Willie Grimes found himself in. Grimes, who is black, was tried and convicted for a sexual assault against an elderly white woman in Hickory in 1987. He was sentenced to life in prison. Grimes was shuffled from various prisons throughout the state and was ill throughout most of his prison stay. He maintained that he was innocent throughout his 24 years behind bars. Through the Innocence Inquiry Commission, a state agency in North Carolina and the first of its kind in the country, Grimes was exonerated of the crime and was released in 2012. By that time, he was in his 60s. Exonerations of the wrongfully convicted are on the rise. This is due in part to DNA evidence, but also a result of tireless work by advocacy groups like the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence, which push for reforms of the criminal justice system. This hour, we examine some of the work being done in the state and hear more about Willie Grimes' case. Joining me in studio is Willie Grimes, by way of WGBH in Boston, author Benjamin Racklin, who chronicled the story of Willie's wrongful conviction in the new book, Ghost of the Innocent Man, and by phone, Chris Mumma, executive director of the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence. She represented Willie and advocates for the wrongfully convicted. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Glad to be here.
So, Benjamin, I'm going to start with you. What piqued your interest in the first place to tell Willie's story and eventually write a whole book about it?
In very early 2013, excuse me, I was living down in Wilmington when, and I was 26 years old, when I came across a tiny headline in a local newspaper, I think it was the Wilmington Star News, about this man who'd just been exonerated after 24 years in prison. And I happened to be the middle of three brothers, and the age gap between me and the youngest is 2 years. And so 24 years was my brother's age exactly. And so it was an amount of time I had a context for. I realized this guy, this Willie Grimes, had spent my brother's entire lifetime behind prison and had done so wrongly. And so I became obsessed with these questions of, you know, who is this guy? How did this happen? What was it like for him? Who were these folks who'd finally proved him innocent? What was Willie's life like now? And I spent about the next 4.5 years, almost 5 years, finding out the answers to those questions.
Yeah. And through writing this book, you've spent a lot of time looking at the investigation and what went on exactly that night in 1987 when this assault took place. Can you take us back to that night, what police said happened?
Sure. So in October of 1987 in this small town of Hickory, which is about an hour west of where many of your listeners will be in Charlotte, an elderly woman was assaulted in her home. An unfamiliar man knocked on her door, forced his way in, assaulted her, and then vanished into darkness. Willie, that evening, was well across town at a house party with a number of friends, all of whom vouched for his alibi later in writing and affidavits and at trial, that he was with them. There was no way he possibly could have been that man. Besides which, he just wasn't that kind of person. I mean, there was no way that the Willie they knew would have been involved in something like this. And nonetheless, he was convicted. There were sort of two pieces of evidence that figured into that conviction most prominently. The first was a hair recovered from the scene was said to be, quote, microscopically consistent with Willie's, meaning that they supposedly looked identical visually under a microscope. We now know that that is not a conclusive piece of evidence. We knew that less well in 1987 and 88. The second piece of erroneous evidence was that the victim herself came to believe that she recognized Willie in a lineup. And so Willie was convicted for her assault.
And Willie, as Benjamin said, you were at a party that night of the assault, and many people vouched for you that you couldn't have possibly committed this crime. But when you hear that police are looking for you, you actually go down to the police station yourself to see what's going on. What was going through your head in that moment when you decided to drive down to the police station?
Well, I had just got home from work, and I was living with a lady named Brenda Smith. She told me that the police had been there looking for me, and I didn't know what they could be looking for me for. So I asked her, could she carry me to the police station, because I knew I hadn't did anything, and I wanted to find out what they were looking for me for. So she agreed to carry me up there, and when she carried me up there, I went in there, was talking to them, and they said that we don't know anything about it, but Lee Hunt's supposed to have some wants, and he's on his way here. We'll let you, letting him know that you is here. So they did, and when he arrived, he came to me, and he was talking to me, and he asked me that I know I was in big trouble, and I told him no, because I hadn't did anything. And he said, well, we have a bunch of wants on you for doing different things, and you was in big trouble, so best you be quiet. And I said, no, I haven't did anything. I take a lie detector test or anything, because I know I haven't did anything. So he said, best you be quiet, and told him to go ahead and book me. And I was been locked up ever since then.
And you end up spending over 2 decades in prison for this crime you didn't commit. And along the way, I know that you're passed off to a lot of different lawyers. But eventually, you're put in touch with a Charlotte lawyer named Noel Tin, who puts you in touch with a nonprofit called the North Carolina Center on Actual Innocence, which is where Chris Mumma comes in. Chris, your organization does a lot of work on getting wrongful convictions overturned. But it also led to a unique state agency called the Innocence Inquiry Commission. Can you explain what that is and why it was needed?
So the reason the commission was established was because innocence organizations like the Center on Actual Innocence can only do so much. We believed in Willie's case. There were a lot of red flags associated with the conviction, from the identification to the microscopic hair comparison that Benjamin mentioned to the informant who first raised Willie's name as the suspect. And we tried to find the physical evidence so that it could be tested and get access to files so that we could conduct additional investigation. But what we run into is brick walls. We can't get access. And even though we're told evidence doesn't exist, we can't have confidence that that's true. So the Innocence Inquiry Commission was established to address those issues, access and transparency, and to get past any legal procedural bars that might be raised.
And as you mentioned, there were several red flags that jumped out at this case in particular. What were some of the specifics that really that caught you, that made you want to work on this case?
Well, in 2003... you know, it was very clear that witness identification or victim identification, particularly in cross-race cases where there's either white identifying black or black identifying white or Asian, it goes all ways. We can't, our minds are not recorders, and we have difficulty remembering features of someone who's from a different race that we're not as familiar with. So in this case, we had a cross-race identification. The identification testimony from the victim was very, very weak at trial, so it was a major red flag. Microscopic hair comparison had already been proven to be unreliable, and there had already been exoneration cases where microscopic hair comparison had been used to convict somebody, and so that was something we were focused on in Willie's case. So we had the conviction factors, but then again, one of the leading things was Willie himself. His sincerity and gentleness came across in his communications. And so in addition to the legal red flags, we had this person who just made it clear that he was the kind of person who wouldn't do this kind of act. And it wasn't just an assault. It was a brutal rape, a rape in one room and then moved to another room and raped again. So it was a brutal act.
Well, Willie, I can't imagine how frustrating this whole thing must have been for you to have certain people believe you that you're innocent, people like Chris and other lawyers, even the first lawyer that represented you from the start. How did you keep going when you were in prison, when things in the system just seemed to be moving so slowly and not knowing if you would actually ever get out?
Well, I knew I couldn't give up. And the main thing, I knew that I was innocent. And I kept on reaching out for different people to try to help me, never could find anyone. So once I became a Jehovah's Witness, this family actually took me in like I was their own son, even though I was just as old as he was. And went to the different of trying to do anything they could to try to help me and this and that because they believed in me. And when they came talking to me, they would come every weekend because at the time I hadn't been baptized at first, but they still believed in me. And after I got baptized, his wife always said that I can listen to him and tell that he's not guilty and he's not lying. And I told her I didn't have no reason to lie. So when I got Jehovah on my side and went to understanding his ways and reactions, it just gave me more power and more will to feel like I might as well die in there before I would say I was guilty of something that I didn't do. So we kept on reaching and trying to find different avenues to try to help me. We came to a couple places where Chris said, there's nothing else I could do. I'm not going to give up. I'm going to try to look for different avenues. It made me feel sad and down, but I knew I couldn't give up because I knew I was innocent. And they kept on trying to get me to sign papers saying I was guilty of this and that so I could get out. And I told them I would never do nothing like that because I know I'm innocent and I would be lying against Jehovah if I did. And I would rather die and never lie against him or lie to just to get out. So it was just an up and down thing with me all doing the tests.
So, Willie, you were offered more than once an opportunity while you were in prison to enroll in a program that was for sex offenders, which you were at one point considered. But you turned this down even though it would have helped you maybe get out quicker because this would have meant admitting guilt. And this is while you were in the prison system. Several times you were asked to join this program. Did you ever, were you ever tempted to change your mind?
No, I wasn't in attempt to change my mind, but I did go back to my program's office and told him that I would go to the program, but I wouldn't sign papers saying I was guilty of the crime, if that would help me. And he told me that you couldn't go to the program without signing papers saying that you were guilty. So I told him I had to refuse it because I couldn't sign papers saying I was guilty of something I didn't do.
Coming up in the next segment, we'll hear what life is like for Willie Grimes since he's been free. We'll continue this conversation after a short break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes this morning from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony, presenting an evening of Beethoven and Brahms, including Beethoven's only violin concerto, plus Brahms Symphony No. 4, tomorrow and Friday at Belk Theater. Information at charlottesymphony.org. And from Atrium Animal Hospital and Wellness Center, providing holistic animal health care for 20 years, offering pet parents a strategy to achieve and maintain furry family vitality. AtriumAnimalHospital.com. On the next Charlotte Talks, the local news roundup, the outside expert brought in by judges to redraw legislative districts in North Carolina has rolled out a draft of a new map. Mecklenburg County's health director apologizes for a comment about rising rates of HIV in the county. Another Charlotte's Mecklenburg school bus catches fire, triggering a safety review of the CMS fleet. Guest host Eric Spanberg and our panel of reporters will recap the week's news tomorrow morning at 9. You're on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, President Trump is remaking the federal bench, naming judges in record numbers, some called unqualified. We'll dive in. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for On Point from 10 till noon following Charlotte Talks. You're on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. This hour, we're exploring the story of Willie Grimes, a North Carolina man who was wrongfully convicted of a crime he didn't commit and served 24 years for. He was eventually exonerated with the help of Chris Mumma of the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence. Our guests include Willie Grimes, Chris Mumma, and author Benjamin Racklin. His book, The Ghost of the Innocent Man, follows Willie's story. What has life been like for you since you were freed from prison?
Oh, I have had a real good life since I've been out. Main thing, trying to be a faithful Jehovah Witness. I've been trying to stay faithful to Him. I haven't been doing too much anything except mowing my yard and trying to keep clean around the house. I have one more house that I take care of because this lady live on Muller Beach and don't ever come in but two times a year. So I keep clean around there. And other than that, I don't do too much anything.
Well, we're so appreciative of you doing this interview today. And I know that a lot of folks have been wanting to hear from you more and more, especially since this new book came out this year. Is it helpful in your process of moving on from what happened? Is it hard to talk about that time in prison?
No, it's not hard to talk about because I just feel like justice has been did, not from the prison system, but from work that Chris have been doing and trying to get created so that North Carolina can go to heaven. People that's in prison for something that they didn't do, because there's a lot of them here and have no kind of help or no way to get out.
Speaking of the book, Benjamin, the title is Ghost of the Innocent Man. I've heard you tell the story a couple of times of where the idea for the title of the book came, and I was hoping you could share that with our listeners.
For most of the history of the American criminal justice system, it was thought that we were uniquely well-suited to find the truth and find justice, and that though errors or wrongful convictions might happen abroad in other countries, that that would never happen here in America. And that belief was held by pretty much everyone from, the lawyers taking on the cases all the way up to Supreme Court justices were quoted in writing and verbally making statements to this effect. And in 1923, a Court of Appeals judge, who is my favorite name I've ever heard of any judge because his name was Learned Hand, as part of a larger decision, wrote, "Under our criminal procedure, the accused has every advantage. Our dangers do not lie in too little tenderness toward the accused. Our procedure has always been haunted by the ghost of the innocent man convicted. It is an unreal dream." And what he was saying was what I just described, that the fear that we might be convicting the wrong people was unfounded. It wouldn't happen in America.
I want to take a step back and talk a little bit about DNA and how it's used today but wasn't able to be used for Willie's case. So, Chris, maybe you'd be the best person to talk about this. What can you tell us about how DNA testing is helping in these more recent cases of people who may have been wrongfully convicted?
Sure. You know, Willie's case is really fascinating in that after he was convicted, his defense attorney actually asked for DNA testing at the end of the trial, which was very early to be thinking about that approach. But unfortunately, it was never followed up with before the evidence was destroyed. So it was just on, DNA was just on the horizon at that point. And there's been 351 DNA exonerations across the country so far. So it not only helps exonerate the innocent, it helps to solve crimes more accurately as they occur today because the DNA is more conclusive evidence against those who do perpetrate the crimes. In about 47% of the DNA exoneration cases, that same DNA that was used to exonerate someone was used to identify the true perpetrator. So as in Willie's case, where the true perpetrator, Albert Turner, was identified, that's the perfect justice storm. When someone's exonerated, the victim finally gets justice and the true perpetrator gets justice. DNA is not only used for exonerations and solving crimes, but it also has taught us what we used to think was reliable. It was not so reliable, such as the microscopic hair comparison, bite marks, tool marks, blood spatter, fingerprints. So it's taught us a lot about the quote-unquote sciences we were relying on before and how those need to be challenged.
You're listening.
It also taught us that we were mistaken to believe what I just described, that that wrongful conviction could never occur here. In addition to those cases where DNA is available and can prove that we've gotten it wrong in one particular case, DNA proved scientifically and more broadly that if we could get it, that we could get it wrong. And if we could get it wrong in some of those cases where DNA was available, then certainly we could get it wrong in other cases as well.
Hmm. Well, as we have made these great strides as far as DNA goes, looking back at this case in particular, and again, it was 1987, so times were different and the technology was different. But it looked like there were some basic things that were just overlooked that are painful to look back at. I'm thinking about the fruit. The victim had said that the perpetrator had taken some fruit from a bowl that was in her home, and police found some fruit, but that fruit was never really tested. Nothing came from that. So my question to you, Benjamin, and to you, Chris, is what do you think, or how do you think police would have handled that case, Willie's case, differently if it would have happened today in 2017? Would we have seen some of the same mistakes, or would it have been different?
No, I think the investigation would have been very different when that apple core was found in the middle of the street by Steve Hunt and taken back. So he it was interesting that he understood enough about the importance of the apple to pick it up and collect it, but then he took it back to the department and he promptly threw it in the trash. Probably thinking it was not a good item for getting fingerprints from, but it's a great item for getting DNA from, because you'd have the saliva of the person who ate from the apple, and they knew that the apple was taken from the fruit bowl. The same thing with the banana peels that were left on the sidewalk outside the apartment. That one's a little harder to understand because they did collect the fingerprints from the bananas on the table, which is, of course, how the case ends up being solved in the end. I think the fingerprint database banks today, you know, just the fact that the fingerprints were taken from the banana, they would have been run through that fingerprint databank that ended up identifying Albert Turner. So there's been a lot of advances, not only in the technology and in the science, but in the way investigations are conducted. ID procedures have been established in a lot of places across the country. North Carolina passed statute changing the way identification procedures are conducted back in 2008, and I am pretty confident under those procedures, the victim in this case would not have been able to identify Mr. Grimes.
Hmm. You're listening to Charlotte Talks, and we're discussing the true story of Willie Grimes, a man wrongfully convicted of a crime he spent 24 years in prison for. My guests are Benjamin Racklin, the author of The Ghosts of the Innocent Man, and Chris Mumma, an attorney and executive director of the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence, and Willie Grimes. Benjamin and Chris, I have a question for both of you, and Chris, I'll go ahead and start with you. What surprises you about doing this type of work, advocating for people you believe are wrongfully convicted?
Well, unfortunately, what surprises me is that I believe everybody should be advocating for the innocent. I can't imagine, regardless of your political party or your position as a prosecutor or defense attorney or just a citizen, that we all wouldn't want to be correct in this, these type of injustices. I can't think of something worse than being behind bars for something I didn't do. It's just, if you think about how much is being taken from that person and the pain that they're suffering at the same time, it is the definition of tragedy. So what surprises me the most is that organizations like the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence, we are very, very careful in screening out these cases and only approach prosecution probably once or twice a year. And there's a lot of prosecutors across the state, so very few times are we disrupting anybody's schedule or resources to say, hey, take a pause and look at this case with us. But we are just never met with even agreement to meet with us to discuss the case. The adversarial system just carries over into everything, and that continues to surprise me.
And Benjamin, what surprised you through your research for doing this book?
I think a lot surprised me. I was surprised to learn how ill-equipped our criminal justice system is for a person like Willie. I think I assumed that even in a case where occasionally we got things wrong, and certainly we had an entire robust appeals system, and a person like Willie, who had been convicted in error, could certainly file an appeal and be out really quickly. It was a surprise to me to learn that innocence is not an appealable issue in American jurisprudence. In other words, once Willie was convicted, there was no appeal where that he could file that said, they got it wrong, I'm in fact innocent, it wasn't me. The appeal system in America doesn't evaluate innocence or guilt. It evaluates procedural and constitutional claims, whether or not a defendant's or a convicted person's rights have been met versus violated at trial. And so if the procedure of a trial does not explicitly violate Willie's rights, but the outcome is simply wrong, then he's out of luck. The appeal system is of extremely limited use for him. And that's the scenario he found himself in. Another surprise for me, and this relates to your last question, is that not every wrongful conviction features a villain. That there are sometimes bad actors, and I think television and movies teach us that every case where things have gone astray must include one of those people. And in fact, sometimes a case can simply go wrong for any one of a variety of reasons, not directly tied to some bad faith actor, sometimes due to limited understanding, sometimes due to limited science, sometimes due to honest error or misunderstanding. And the fact that any one of those human elements can result in, as Chris described, a really catastrophic tragedy was a source of surprise and horror to me. And I mean, I will say that in one of the reasons Willie's case was so fascinating to me and makes such a vivid, interesting story, I think, is that really his case featured, I think, I would say both those things, that there was some bad faith, but there was also incomplete understanding. Mm-hmm. And when those two were compounded, Willie really entered a gauntlet.
I'm sure a lot of people that are listening and hearing Willie's story for the first time are wondering, was this just lazy police work or was this something indicative of the times? Is it one or the other? Could it be a little bit of both?
Well, Chris and I might answer this question a little bit differently because we come to it with different experiences, and Chris works firsthand with so many of these cases. From my perspective, someone who came to Willie's story without prior experience to the law, and really just with a fascination and human curiosity about this extraordinary circumstance, I am instinctively reluctant to do too much Monday morning quarterbacking. I'm reluctant to sort of try to get inside the head of someone, you know, 20, 25, 30 years ago and what they did and didn't understand, what they did and didn't know. Our understanding of how the system works, of how the human brain works, how memory works, of some of these forms of what we thought counted as evidence and have since learned that is not so much evidence, has developed so much that I think it's really hard, at least for me, to distinguish what was bad faith and what was honest misinformation or misunderstanding. I will say that, you know, and I would answer that probably differently depending on which question is involved. A case like Willie's involves many different people, many different questions, and the answers to each of those questions might include some of each. And I think part of what I wanted to do was show vividly and accurately what happened and how different people answered certain questions. And I think the book provides a pretty fair and clear opportunity for readers to conclude what was sort of an artifact of the times and what was an individual authority behaving in ways that not only was not in the interest of Willie, but really was not in the interest of the victim and the victim's family in this case, who wanted justice as much as anyone.
I think we would probably answer the question a different way. I would say it was a combination of both bad actor and bad policing and unintentional consequences. But those unintentional consequences came from tunnel vision in the investigation, where they had a name, and then the evidence that pointed away from that name was less important, and any evidence that they could construe to point towards that name became more important. So the concerning part is, with what we know about tunnel vision now and what we know about human bias and what we know about wrongful convictions, is that we don't take what we've learned and study cases like Willie's to say, how do we keep this from happening again? You know, like when an airplane crashes, we go and we look at why that happened. We don't do that in wrongful conviction cases. And when we learned that microscopic hair comparison was unreliable back in 2003, 2004, and maybe even earlier than that, we didn't say, well, what about those people we convicted with that bad evidence? Shouldn't we go back and look at those? So those are the areas that are concerning to me, is this inability to learn from our mistakes and to apply what we learn to increase justice in the justice system.
Coming up, we hear more about specific reforms that are attempting to change the criminal justice system. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Duke Energy, investing in technology designed to modernize the Carolinas energy grid over the next 10 years. More at duke-energy.com/future. And from Ashe County, celebrating the arrival of the holidays with Choose and Cut Christmas Tree Farms. Located in the northwest corner of North Carolina, bordering Tennessee and Virginia. Details on Ashe County at thecoolestcorner.com. The federal courts are being rapidly reshaped under President Trump. 8 appellate judges have been appointed so far. That's the fastest pace for a first-year president since Richard Nixon. A 9th nominee is headed for a Senate vote after clearing the Judiciary Committee on a party-line vote, despite questions about his qualifications for the bench. That's the topic coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on Point with Tom Ashbrook. We'll continue our conversation on wrongful convictions and exonerations in North Carolina in a moment here on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Wherever the day's biggest story is unfolding, Morning Edition will connect you to the voices at the center of it all.
Police say a man in a rented Home Depot truck drove...
indictment alleges that Manafort and Gates used... This comes after the Catalan parliament declared independence.
Whether the news is happening close to home or whether it hits close to home, start your day with Morning Edition.
Morning Edition from 5 until 9 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. We're discussing the true story of Willie Grimes, a North Carolina man who was wrongfully convicted of assaulting an elderly woman in Hickory in 1987. He served 24 years in prison while maintaining he was innocent the entire time. His story is the subject of a new book by author Benjamin Racklin, who joins us in Boston by way of WGBH. Willie Grimes is in studio with us, and Chris Muma joins us by phone. She is the executive director of the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence. So North Carolina has been on the forefront of examining cases that have these possible convictions that were wrong to begin with. We have this one-of-a-kind state agency that takes a look into these issues. Why here in the state North Carolina, Chris, and why haven't other states followed our lead?
Well, the real reason why we were able to get this in North Carolina is former Chief Justice I. Beverly Lake. I. Beverly Lake was Republican. He had a strong support for law enforcement and tough on crime approach. And for someone like that to say you can be tough on crime and pro law enforcement and still want to increase the reliability of convictions through changes to investigative procedures and post-conviction review that ensure that we get it right, because when we get it right, victims get justice, the true perpetrator is off the street so we don't have further crime, and the innocent person's not behind bars. So it's because of his leadership that we were able to get reforms established during his tenure and soon after that, identification procedure reforms, as I mentioned, recording of interrogations, preservation of evidence, and the establishment of the Innocence Inquiry Commission. We started working on the establishment of the commission in 2005 for that access reason, and because Justice Lake was concerned about public confidence in the justice system, and when the public hears about someone being in prison for 20, 30 years for something they didn't do, that hurts confidence. Mm. So he wanted these cases to be resolved more quickly and without being resolved in the papers. So the commission was early in ahead of its time. We see a lot of conviction integrity units around the country now being established in prosecutor offices. And that's kind of what we were trying to do in North Carolina. So there are solutions being put in place in other states within individual offices, but those typically are established in offices that have resources, have financial resources, which our offices in North Carolina just don't have. And I think a lot of other states where there's a lot of rural areas will never have. So I'm not sure why it hasn't caught on. Any process you establish needs to be looked at and improved along the way. If there are ones that are established around the country, I think there are changes that need to be made to what we originally established. There are prosecutor offices taking more interest in this issue, and we're seeing as people grew up with wrongful convictions become prosecutors and become defense attorneys, we're going to see that increase.
This is a question anyone can feel free to jump in. It feels like, and we've seen studies and reports, that there are more wrongful convictions that are being cleared today than ever before. Why is that?
Well, I think it's because DNA in one way, but in the other way, there's about four times as many non-DNA exonerations as DNA, and it's because of what we're learning about the fallibility of the justice system and false confessions and the possibility that people who are changing their statements years after their testimony might be telling the truth years later, and willingness of attorneys to investigate cases to find avenues because they now understand that this can happen as well. But the science is changing all around. It used to be we thought we were going to run out of DNA exoneration cases, and because DNA continues to improve over time and become more and more sensitive, even the cases we couldn't test with DNA in the mid-2000s can be tested now. Mm. So it's an ever-evolving process.
I want to talk a little bit about the idea of the system and the system as a whole being broken. And Benjamin, I heard an interview that you did where I really like this thing that you said. You said that the system isn't necessarily broken, it's malformed. Could you explain what do you mean about that?
Broken suggests there was a time when things were running perfectly and accurately, and then something happened to derail it. What we know now is that was never the case. That the system has had flaws since the beginning. And so it's not that it needs to be repaired, it's that it needs to be improved. Now, if that sort of sounds intimidating or impossible, I would optimistically point to a whole suite of available reforms, many of which North Carolina has helped lead the way on. Others, I think, remain to be done. And an organization like the Innocence Inquiry Commission, like nonprofits like CRISIS, the Center for Actual Innocence, which is really a powerful advocate for folks like Willie, and I would say for the victims in these cases, which who have been given a false closure, and for whom real closure is in their interest. I would say too, in response to your earlier question about the number of increasing number of exonerations, I would just encourage listeners to sort of recognize that any headline, any of those numbers that they see corresponds to a real human being, a person like Willie. I mean, these are real people with real lives and real families. And part of the reason I was motivated to write the book is that I had so often seen these headlines with those, you know, the photograph of an exoneree with his lawyer and their hand raised overhead like a boxer. And those articles always give the same bits of information. Person's name, what the crime was, and how long they'd been incarcerated for. And it always frustrated and astonished me that those articles did not answer what to me felt like the most pressing questions, which were, you know, what was this like and who is this person? And that's no criticism of newspaper reporting. I mean, that's accomplishing a different thing. They're conveying information in a really valuable way. But one of the things I was able to pursue in the book that would be impossible in a newspaper headline or a brief article is to really explore the human beings who are living this experience. I didn't want to write a book about an issue. I wanted to write a book about people.
Mm. And speaking of people, Willie, you know, the criminal justice system clearly failed you in a number of ways. How does that affect you now as a person who's out and about in the world? I mean, when you see a police officer, do you feel differently than you did 30, 25 years ago? How does that work for you?
I don't hold no grudge because we do really need the police department, because if we didn't, this world would be in real bad shape. But we need officers in the police department that want to do their job and want to do a job right and not just do a job so that they can go home and say, well, we done did this. They need to get it right from the beginning. And 3/4 of them know right from wrong, even when they're doing the wrong. They know right from wrong. And we need people that is willing to do the right thing and quit just picking on people because of their color or because of their poll ordinance. It really depends on what we really need in the Justice Department, and that's the Justice Department really need help.
I want to talk about this really lovely scene that kind of just shows exactly how difficult this type of work, advocating for people that are wrongfully convicted, is. It's a scene in the book where, Chris, you had just met Willie for the first time. A reporter had wanted to do an article on him and his case, and you went along and met him. And there was a moment in the parking lot afterwards where it just kind of seemed to hit you of, wow, this is a real person. This is his story. Can you kind of take us back to that moment and talk a little bit about the impact of this work?
Yeah. Willie was always a real person to me. There's no question about it. We do try and put off meeting the inmates face-to-face until we're really sure we're going to be able to help in their case, because having all those emotional connections and then having to tell them there's nothing we can do is heart-wrenching. Mm-hmm. But the story that was being done by this reporter was on the importance of preserving evidence and how one person's trash can be somebody else's savior. Mm-hmm. So we went to Susan Green and I went to see Willie, and she interviewed him for the story, and everything that I had seen on paper with his writing and read about his story, and just hearing the gentleness of his voice and him, and he was sick at the time, so it was very sad about, you know, what the future held for him. I remember coming out of the prison and just sitting down on the pavement in the parking lot and crying, and it just, it's really hard. They are real people, and real lives are being lost. And when I speak to people during education forums, I always start with, the fact is that there are innocent people in prison, and the fact is they will die there. That no matter what we do as an organization or anybody else does, there's nothing that can be done for them. So it's incredibly important that we do everything we can to avoid those convictions from happening in the first place.
Through writing this book, Benjamin, I feel like you kind of had a unique perspective of, you were interested in Willie's story, and then you got to dive in and then come out on the other side of it. How has your opinion of the criminal justice system changed since when you first started, since you first heard Willie's story from the beginning? Did you have any big revelations?
I don't know that I had a lot of preconceptions about the criminal justice system at the outset. I mean, beyond being a sort of relatively informed young adult who paid attention to the news, but I had never considered in serious depth a case like Willie's and the path it might take through the system. Or, you know, I knew there were people like Chris, attorneys who had devoted their lives to working on those sorts of cases, but I never considered what that feels and looks like on a weekly, daily, hourly way. I mean, part of the reason I write is because it's an excuse to explore really extraordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. And I get to pursue my curiosities and ask the kinds of questions that I would be impolite to ask if I were not a writer. And so it's been a real privilege to get to know someone like Willie, to get to know someone like Chris, to get to know the people on every side of these issues. I mean, there are a lot of really fascinating stories in this line of work. I think a lot of them deserve a telling. Willie's, from the beginning and all through the 4.5 years, really wouldn't let go of me. I mean, I think he's an extraordinary person. And I was committed at the beginning to try to write his story. Over time, what I discovered is that Willie didn't occur in a vacuum. And so there was this extraordinary, not just bipartisan, because it was more than just Republicans and Democrats. You know, that to to witness and learn about this extraordinary collaboration between prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, law professors, police, crime victims themselves, to speak with people in every one of those constituencies, including, for example, descendants of the victim in this particular case, has been a really extraordinary opportunity. And my mission has been to try to tell that story as accurately and as vividly as possible.
We just have time for one last question, and I want to leave it with you, Willie. If there is one thing that you hope people take away from your story, what do you hope that that is?
I guess the main thing is finding ways to keep things from happening that happened against me. And I think that's the reason he wrote the story the way he did, was to try to get the justice system to understand that it's not always right, but do the right thing when you're out there doing your job. Just quit trying to lay things on someone just to get that name off, that story off the book. Mm-hmm. Get the real fat from the jump.
I want to thank my guest, Chris Mumma, the attorney and executive director of the North Carolina Center for Actual Innocence, and Benjamin Racklin, the author of Ghost of the Innocent Man. And I want to say a special thanks to Willie Grimes for coming into the studio today and sharing his personal story. Thanks so much for all of your time. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and this is Charlotte Talks.